Today's Teisho will be on case 38 in the Book of Serenity. Case 38 is entitled Lin Ji's True Person. Introduction: taking a thief for one's son, taking a servant for the master. Can a broken wooden ladle be your ancestor's skull? A donkey saddle rim is not your father's jawbone either. When breaking earth, separating reeds, how do you discern the master? Case: Lin Ji said to the assembly, "There is a true person with no rank, always going in and out through the portals of your face. Beginners who have not yet witnessed it, look, look." Then a monk came forward and said, "What is the true man of no rank?" Lin Ji got down from the seat, grabbed and held him. The monk hesitated. Lin Ji pushed him away and said, "The true man of no rank. Why, what a piece of dry crap he is." Verse: delusion and enlightenment are opposite, subtly communicated with simplicity. Spring opens the 100 flowers in one puff. Power pulls back 9 bulls in one yank. It's hopeless. The mud and the sand can't be cleared away. Clearly blocking off the eye of the sweet spring, if suddenly it burst forth, it would freely flow. This week I had the chance to give a guest lecture to 25 Japanese teachers, high school teachers, who have been here in New Brunswick for a semester trying to improve their English. They're English teachers in Japanese high schools. And the foreign ministry has a program to improve their English skills. And a number of universities are hosting groups of these high school high school English teachers. Rutgers was lucky enough to get a group of about 25. And I was asked to do a presentation on the influence of Japanese art on American art. And it was really wonderful, if I may say so myself. It was a great lecture. And it was really good because the material was so interesting. I wanted to look at Japanese artists and their influence on various artists. So some of you may know about James McNeill Whistler, who was a great American painter, and he was very, very influenced by the floating world pictures in China, in Japanese art. And he learned many lessons from Japanese artists and applied them in his painting. And then I looked at Hokusai and Hiroshige, and looked at their influence on Georgia O'Keeffe, who was a huge admirer of Japanese art. And then we looked at some paintings by John Cage, who's most famous as a composer, but he's actually quite a great visual artist as well, quite a great painter. And we looked at his work and the work of a Japanese monk named Sengai. I had a really good time doing this because I have been looking at this art for 40 or 50 years, and every time I look at it, it excites me very much. And the students were interested in the subject, and at the end I got a standing ovation, which felt really good. And but the thing that I believe the students found most interesting was that they knew very little about their own traditions. They knew very little about their own traditions. One of the things I did was to bring in a Japanese landscape from about maybe the 10th or 11th century. It's very heavily influenced by Chinese art. It looks like a a Chinese painting with a flat plane and these rocks that come off the ground hundreds of feet into the air, and sort of lush vegetation. It's very clearly a Chinese scene, but the Japanese imitated the Chinese. But I had a projector and I projected the picture on the wall, and I said to the students, what was the artist trying to convey? What was the artist trying to communicate? And they were absolutely stunned by the question. And nobody had ever asked them that question before, even though this was a rather famous Japanese artist. And then I went on to artist after artist, and I kept saying, what is the artist trying to communicate? We looked at a wonderful picture, the famous picture of the Hokusai's wave, which I'm sure some of you have seen. It's in very, very explosive colors, whites and blues. And there's a giant wave. And if you look carefully, there's some fishing boats in the midst of the waves. And the colors are just astonishing. But the people are very small, and they're at the mercy of these giant waves. And I said, what is the artist trying to convey? And they had no idea. I mean, they just literally... And somebody said, you know, in school we study these. Basically, they show us the picture and we're supposed to identify the artist. And so we stay up all night trying to memorize these pictures just so we can pass the test. So is it Hiroshige or is it Hokusai? You know, and if you get it Hokusai right, you know, you get a 90. If you get it wrong, you get a 40, you know, and... And so they have never actually stopped to look at the pictures and ask what they mean. You know, what is the artist trying to convey? And when we did this, when we looked at this early Japanese picture, 11th century Japanese picture, which looked very Chinese. I said, what is the artist trying to convey? And they were very, very uneasy answering that question. You know, the Japanese are very, have many excellent qualities. I really admire the Japanese. They're a little bit, as we used to say, uptight. Do you know that phrase? Do these people still use that word? Uptight. So it made them a little nervous at first for me to say, what do you think this painting could mean? You know, I had the feeling they had been told that this was up to the experts, right? And so I said, well, let's just play around with it. Let's see what it could mean. What could this mean? You know, silence. So I, you know, come on, help me out. And finally, people began to say, "Well, nature, yes, nature, good." You know. What else? You know, and somebody finally noticed that the humans were very small. There were like some little tiny boats floating on the water. There was a little house But the scale of the painting made nature look very vast and the humans look very small. And we sort of plugged away at this picture until this became obvious to everybody. You know, everybody began to agree that this was a message. The painter was sending a message about the human place in nature. And people, I think, were very pleased that they had sort of experienced the picture. You know, so I gave them the picture, projected it on the wall, on the screen. They were at a complete loss, and they wanted, probably this was their education in Japan, they wanted me to tell them what it meant, you know. Or maybe they just wanted me to tell them who had painted it, so they could write down the name and take the test. But when I asked them what the painting actually meant, you know, they were very nervous, very uneasy, and they felt, I think, a little bit lost. And then they had to really engage with the painting without any guarantees that they knew what they were doing. And after a while, they began to respond to the painting with more and more confidence, you know, and they began to take real pleasure in the painting. Now, I think this is a wonderful process, you know, where you look at something new and you don't know what to make of it. And for a long time, you're confused and uncertain. And then somehow things come together, and it comes together. It becomes meaningful. It comes together from like pieces. Suddenly, it coheres into something that's unified. And people were very happy and relieved, right? Because they'd gone through this process. But I think they enjoyed it a lot. So we kept doing this, you know. I put another picture up of pine trees. It's pine, basically, it looks like pine trees in the mist. And I said, I put this picture up on the wall, and I said, what is this all about? And again, you know, what is the artist trying to communicate? And again, you know, there's a lot of hesitation. Like, oh, who am I to know that? You know, I'm not an art historian. I'm not a specialist. But you know, they began to, you could say, be open to the experience, right? Be open to the painting. And you know, people had various possible interpretations of the painting. We began to notice that some of the panels, it was a multi-panel painting. It was like a folding screen that had been opened up, and there were two pine trees emerging out of the mist. And so in one panel you could just barely see a pine tree. Then in the next panel you could see the pine tree. Then in the next panel mist, in the next panel emerging pine tree, then another pine tree, then mist. See? And you know, the painting was really asking you to experience it, you know. It's saying, come over here and go through a process with me. You know, please join me in this. You know? And so we began to play the game. You know, we began to say, what could this mean? And again, you know, people were uneasy. They were unsure. But little by little, you know, we began to engage with the painting, and it became more and more pleasing, more and more liberating, you know. And finally, you know, again, we kind of felt like we had encountered the painting, and very exciting for these students. Later on, I gave them a picture. I put a picture on the wall of it's a very famous artwork by a Japanese monk from the 15th century named Sengai, S-E-N-G-A-I. And there's a bunch of calligraphy on the left-hand side, and on the right-hand side there's an empty circle. I asked them to read the calligraphy. Please, can anybody read this calligraphy? And they tried and tried and tried, and they couldn't read it. And I said, how do you feel about that? Are you frustrated? Are you mad? People were wrestling with the fact that they didn't know why Sengai had been so sloppy, why his calligraphy was so sloppy they couldn't read it. And they couldn't read any of the characters, But it was clearly saying something, right? And then, so there's this calligraphy saying something, and then on the right-hand side there's an empty circle. That we tried to interpret it. Several students made an effort. They couldn't read the characters. And I said, how does this make you feel? Nobody had ever asked them that before. You're looking at a work of art. How do you feel? And finally, one of the students said, I swear this happened. I'm not making this up for the purposes of the Teisho. One very nice young woman said, she said, freedom. Everybody loved that interpretation. Freedom. This was, I think, what got me the standing ovation. It wasn't really me, it was Sengai was getting the standing ovation. I think Japanese people are very highly regimented, and they have a very, very demanding life. I was reading the other day that the average Japanese person commutes like 4 hours a day or something, Many Japanese people, it's hard to own a house in Japan. So if you own a house, you don't just sell your house and buy another house. If you've ever gotten a house, you hold on to it, and your job might be, hours and hours away. So people commute on these very good trains, but they commute for hours, and they work long hours. And in school, they're very, very competitive schooling. So probably what happened to them in my class had never happened to them before. And they really enjoyed it. At the end of the class, somebody actually read a little statement about what had gone on in the class, which was totally impromptu. Nobody had hadn't asked anybody to do it. But he did. He said, we never understood that this was part of our tradition, this freedom. It was forgotten, Some of this is history, Some of the reason is, the Japanese tried to avoid Western colonialism. And they closed their country down after they saw the Philippines get completely destroyed by the Spanish. And they really shut Japan down, and only a few Dutch people could come in. But in the 1850s, an American gunboat came into Yokohama Harbor and basically said it was a huge boat filled with guns, and the captain of the ship, who was really an admiral, Admiral Perry, sent a message to the Japanese and said, you must open your country to the United States or we'll attack Yokohama. So the Japanese said, okay, we'll do it. And after that, the Japanese panicked, and they decided they had to industrialize very rapidly or they would be invaded. So ever since, the Japanese have been working night and day trying to be safe. And these were the these children, they weren't really children, these teachers, who were very young, looked very young to me, were a product of that history. But old monk Sengai was trying to tell them a very different lesson than the one their culture gives them today. You know, Sengai knew how to do calligraphy. He was actually very good. But he was trying to tell them something, that it's more important for you to have a certain kind of freedom and for him to have a certain kind of freedom than it is to have readable calligraphy. So it's a really like radical message. It would be like I teach writing, and it would be like my telling my students, don't worry about punctuation, just get the meaning right. See, I would probably lose my job if I did that. And I don't say that to my students. But Sengai is really kind of saying that. Saying, don't worry about that. What really matters is a certain kind of energy or a certain kind of freedom. See, and this has been buried in Japan. This has like been buried, the secret. In Japan, Zen is often associated with like a repression, like a harsh discipline. Sometimes criminals are sent to Japanese Zen temples. Mm-hmm. And that's a terrible idea. Sometimes businessmen, business companies who have employees who are out of line, will send them to a Zen temple to be whipped into shape. And this is a very, very sad, and mistaken. Because as I was trying to get the students to see, at the heart of the Chan, at the heart of Zen, is this celebration of great freedom. This goes back to China. Zen is all about a kind of special kind, the liberation of human freedom. My students were really grateful. These teachers were really grateful for this, because this is like the secret history, the repressed history of Japan. And once they understood this code in the Zen art, it was just like we could look at picture after picture and it all made sense. I was talking about with them about, we looked at these pictures and I pointed out how in many of the pictures, in many of the paintings, they're really ink paintings, there were large empty spaces. Like you'd have a pine tree and then next panel nothing, pine tree, next panel nothing. And I said, this is very, very important. Because this nothingness is really quite central to like freedom, to the freedom we were talking about. If you look at a Persian carpet, every square... by the way, I love Persian carpets, Middle Eastern carpets. They're beautiful, incredibly beautiful, so I'm not criticizing them. If you look at one, and we have a couple in my house that are really not from Persia, they're from Sears. But they look like Persian carpets, and they're very beautiful. Every square inch has some kind of little design in it. It's very nice. Every square inch has a little design. But if you look at Chinese carpets, it's very different. See, because there are some designs, but there's large empty spaces. And I'm told by art historians that's quite unique. That empty spaces are not really permitted in art, but they show up in China and East Asia. In Western painting too, there's no tradition of like no background, you know, just empties the canvas. You fill up every space. But in these Chinese and early Chinese paintings and Japanese paintings, there's like lots of empty space. And the empty space is a part of this teaching of freedom. Freedom. There's a connection between empty space, freedom, and Mu. What is it? I was trying to explain how Zen works last night to some people in Princeton. And I talked about an experience that happened to me, a couple of experiences that happened to me. And maybe you've had these experiences too, but I had the chance to go to Honolulu a few years ago on my 30th wedding anniversary. And, everybody had been raving about Hawaii. It was beautiful, you know, it was very beautiful. But, there were moments where it just didn't click. Parts of it just didn't click with me. Kauai is very beautiful, the island, the small island of Kauai. But the big island is so-so, in my opinion. You know, it just didn't click, you know. It just didn't click. And you think, why is that? You know, why didn't Hawaii excite me or make me feel alive? But I told that story, and then I told another story, which is also true. You know, my friend Larry Sullivan and I used to have summer jobs back in early 70s. In the early 70s, I could pay my whole tuition with my summer job, believe it or not. At a public university, tuition was so cheap that you could pay it off with what you made during the summer. So I could make $1,000 during the summer, and I worked for $3 an hour. I could make $1,000, and I could pay off my tuition. So every summer, my friend Larry Sullivan and I worked construction, and we had these terrible, dusty, dirty jobs digging ditches and things like that. On Friday night, we would jump in his father's car. His family had two cars, and his father would lend us his car. And we would drive out of Washington, D.C., and we would go up into the Shenandoah Mountains, the Shenandoah National Park. And we had a place where we would stay that was, it's called Camp Hoover, and it's on this wonderful, wonderful mountain, little mountain stream. It's almost a river. It's one of these mountain rivers where it comes through the mountains with great force, even though it's not that wide. And there's lots of big boulders, and as the water rolls over the boulders, it vibrates. You know, it makes a real audible hum. And we would camp there, and then we'd go hiking the next day. So usually we'd leave on Friday night after work. We'd go home and take a shower, and then we'd meet up and we'd drive a couple hours. We'd get there late at night. If it weren't raining, we'd just sleep on our sleeping bags on the ground, and then we'd get up the next day and we'd go hiking. It was so rejuvenating. But one night we got there. It was very late. We got out of the car, and there was a full moon in the sky. And we decided to go for a walk along this road that followed this river that made this humming noise. It was like this very powerful mountain stream. It's probably only 20 feet across or something like that. Much of the stream bed was rock, you know. Anyway, we started walking, and the moon was overhead, and the leaves were blowing a little bit in the wind. And when you look down at the ground, the shadows, you could see the light, bright light and shadows sort of swirling a little bit. And Larry, who was actually like a very hard-headed guy, you know, my friend Larry is a wonderful person, but he's like very skeptical about everything. He was like a philosophy major, and I would always say things and he'd tear them apart. I'd say something and he'd show me how that was a logical fallacy and he'd shred it to pieces. So, but Larry still liked nature, and we were out there, and Larry said, "Do you feel that?" And I said, "Yes." You know, it was like magic. It was like magic. You know, and it was like it was as though the boundary between. I mean, I didn't say that to him. You know, he said it to me. He said, "Do you feel that?" It was like a waking dream. You know, everything seemed so intensely alive. You know, you could say, well, it was a combination of factors. You know, it was the moon, it was the shadows, it was the river. But, you know, I've been in places, I've seen the moon before, you know, on a summer night. You know, I've seen leaves blowing in the wind. I've been by many little mountain rivers, you know, but something about that experience was magical. I think a deeper part of the mind is activated by some events, you know. And what I would say is that. You know, basically, we put a lot of faith in, you know, the rational mind, in reason and consciousness. So, you know, there's like this everyday mind that is everyday mind that is a sort of like reasonable, rational, calculating mind, and this is a very good thing, you know. You know, but we overemphasize it. You know, we overemphasize it. And so we are like if you think about it, it's like one. This is a little bit crude, but it's like one hemisphere of our brain is very, very big and powerful, and one hemisphere has become very, very weak and small. You know, and what we don't have is kind of like balance in our life. Mental balance. So we live in this world of ideas and evaluation and judgment and comparison, and the world of sort of like ordinary waking consciousness. I think that is a very small world, and I think when you live there too much, you begin to have a lot of anxiety, hesitation, self-doubt. But there's this other world, you know, this other way of experiencing the world, I should say, which comes from activating the other part of our mind, you know. It's that part of the mind which is intuitive, connective, synthetic. It connects things together. And it's primarily on. It works mysteriously in ways that we can't be conscious of. So you know, my feeling is that people have become very unbalanced in the modern world. You know, those Japanese students are no exception. When they look at a painting, they think about the date. They think about the artist's name. They might think about the name for the style, right? But that isn't really experiencing the painting. You know, to experience the painting, you have to sort of let your unconscious mind out. You know? You sit in front of the painting for a long time or a short time, and you don't know what to say or how to situate yourself or where to start. But it's this other kind of mind, this other part of the mind which is unconscious, that is beginning to formulate something. In the beginning, it's like we saw this picture of these pine trees emerging out of the mist, you know. The awareness of the painting, the understanding of the painting, comes out of the unconscious mind like a pine tree emerging from the mist. This is how the mind really works. It's like if you look at you look at something, at first it might not make any sense, and then all of a sudden it all fits together and it has a coherence. And you didn't think that coherence into existence, it suddenly popped into your awareness. And that processing was done by a different part of your mind, by your unconscious mind. So this is actually tremendously liberating for people when the two parts of the mind operate in tandem, when they're balanced. You know, and my feeling is that Zen is all about learning how to bring those two parts of the mind into balance. There is a really important place in life for the discriminating mind. But, you know, the discriminating mind doesn't create that sense of connectedness, that deep sense of coherence. The unified mind experiences the world as part of itself. And so, you know, this unconscious processing is really neglected and forgotten. But when we begin to use both parts of our mind, the world comes alive in the most exciting way. So, you know, when my students were looking at these pictures, they had to start using that intuitive mind, And things emerged out of the unconscious just looking at this painting. You know, they thought of this, they thought of that. And gradually the painting became meaningful. It became part of themselves and part of their lives, right? Psychologically part. Now, when you go through a museum and you just note the painting's names, the paintings are not part of you. You haven't allowed them to become part of your life. When you look at the painting and you begin to struggle with what it means, you begin to become one with the painting. And it's transforming you. It's transforming you, you know. So you go through a process with the painting, and at the end of it, it's part of your life. It's part of who you are. See? And now that's a unified mind in accord with the way. So one way to think about this koan, you know, when people read this koan, Linji said to the assembly, "There is a person of no rank going in and out through the portals of your face. If you haven't noticed it, notice it." See, there's this, you know, one day you get up and you go outside and it just seems like the usual backyard. You know, one day you go outside and you hear some bird singing and you turn around and you feel totally one with the world. You know, what's the difference? The difference is whether you've activated this intuitive mind, this connective mind. And Zen is all about this. You know, Zen is like training for using both parts of the mind. You know, the modern person overdevelops the discriminating mind, the thinking and analyzing mind, and it's very important to have a well-developed mind of that kind. But if you live too much in that mind, everything becomes a little bit lifeless and stale, and also you become fearful because things are so uncontrollable, right? Things are basically uncontrollable, unforeseeable, and unpredictable. So too much of the conscious discriminating mind produces like nervousness, fear, you know. When we can have more balance in our mental lives, when we can cultivate this intuitive mind more fully, we develop a deep sense of trust. Trust. Somehow you look at this painting and you don't know what it means, and then after a while a meaning arises. You begin to see it. And then you look at another painting and you're worried and you're frustrated, and then all of a sudden you get it. At one point in the lecture, I gave students a passage from John Cage, and he was talking about music, and he said, when a piece of music is performed, nothing has been accomplished. When a piece of music is heard, nothing has been accomplished. And he went through a little list like this. Every time something happens, he said, nothing has been accomplished. And after that, I had a picture. I reproduced a picture of the great rock garden at Ryoanji, which shows these stones arising out of nothingness, basically. It's a dry garden where the foundation is just raked gravel, and then there's these isolated stones coming out of the gravel. And this teaching is about basically the proper way to experience the world, which is to allow the world to emerge into consciousness from this unconscious processing. So anyway, Zen is all about learning how to process unconsciously. You know, if the teacher gives you a koan, the teacher might give you the koan, what is the sound of one hand clapping? And this, you sit down on the cushion and you can't process this with your discriminating mind. You have to process this with your intuitive mind. And you watch the breath and you go into deep mushin, and then sooner or later, it's like staring at a painting you can't understand. All of a sudden, it comes together. And it might come together in many different ways. It might come together as a rush of energy. It might come together as an insight. It might come together as a particular activity you have to do. So it comes together in different ways at different times, but you're learning how to use this other part of your mind. And when we can use both parts of our mind, this is like a special kind of freedom. Special kind of freedom. So Lin Ji was walking around telling people, look, your mind is unbalanced. You're living too much in the small mind, which is the discriminating mind. You need to allow the vast mind to operate more freely. And the way to get access to that vast mind is through Mu. In Zen, we do it through Mu. So every time you call Mu and your mind goes blank, that's like opening the door into your unconscious mind. When you look at your unconscious mind, you never see anything except blankness. It never changes. There's one exception to that. But it never changes. So when you look at the unconscious mind, there's never a form there, you know. You never see the face of Buddha in your unconscious mind. There isn't any face in your unconscious mind. So to the conscious mind, the unconscious mind always just looks blank and dark or empty. But when you begin to say Mu on the cushion, you're opening the door to your unconscious processing. And you will have insights that are coming out of the depths of your being, so to speak. Lin Ji said to the assembly, there is a true person with no rank always going out and coming in through the portals of your face, through the doors of your face. Beginners who have not witnessed it, look. A monk came forward and said, what is the man of no rank? Lin Ji got down from the seat, grabbed him and held him. The monk hesitated. Lin Ji pushed him away and said, the true man of no rank, what a piece of dry crap he is. So what Lin Ji is really saying there is, look, don't think about this discursively. Don't think about this using the small mind. Go, let your mind go blank and trust your deeper intuition, right? That monk was, Linji gave the monk some advice. He said, don't doubt your ability, don't doubt your intuitive mind. Trust it. But the student is so in doubt about his intuitive mind that he turns it into a concept again, right? Instead of using it to experience reality. So Linji says, oh well, that didn't work out very well. So to practice Zen, basically, is to cultivate a balanced mind. We're learning how to liberate ourselves by opening the door into the unconscious processing, which is the only way, really, to connect to the world, to connect fully with the world. Verse, delusion and enlightenment are opposite, subtly communicated with simplicity. Spring opens the 100 flowers in one puff. Power pulls back 9 bulls in one yank. It's hopeless. The mud and the sand can't be cleared away, clearly blocking off the eye of the sweet spring. If suddenly it bursts forth, it would freely flow. So the message is basically we overemphasize one kind of intelligence, and we don't emphasize enough the other kind of intelligence. And when we cultivate Mu Xin, when we cultivate that deep intuitive mind, the spring, the natural spring of our own energy, joy, and creativity is going to flow freely. So, for that reason alone, thank you for coming today to sit. Thank you.